This is a HeadGum Original. Have you gotten anything free yet? Have you?
No, and it's a dang shame. Is that what the pro is of hosting podcasts? You get free
You're supposed to get a mattress. I feel like when you get a podcast, that's what you get. You're honored with the mattress.
Honestly, I feel like we're engaging in all this shop talk, this industry talk, because we're too afraid to confront the mountain that stands before us. We have this this titanic towering hit. And I swore I wasn't going to start the show this way, but you guys are forcing my hand by trying to get me to talk about anything except Tom Petty. And that's what I want to talk about, and I won't back down.
Let's punch it.
Punch up the jam, punch it up.
It's like asbestos. You have to. It's safer to just cover it up.
Yeah.
Or not touch it, then try to remove it.
Just to cover it up.
This is how we fell into this trap the first time.
I'm just like, I'm
because
just struggling.
I'm dope sick on nostalgia.
I'm just struggling not to keep talking about McAdoo's, frankly.
Let's do it for real. Let's do this.
Welcome back to Punch Up the Jam. We are so excited to be here this week with Jason Gore and Kristen Bartlett, two hilarious comics. You may know Jason as the producer of The Best Show, one of the greatest radio shows or podcasts of all time. We'll talk about that. And you may know Kristen as the head writer of Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, but we've known you guys for a long time.
We have a personal connection. It's true. It's
a really long time. For me, it's been like, what, 11, 12 years? And for you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. We met you when you guys were dating in Georgia, but Jason is from the same hometown as Andrew and I. Andrew and I are so close, we actually grew up in the same house, but Jason is close enough to us that we grew up in the same town and even performed in the same high school marching band.
Yeah, the Radford High School Marching Bobcats.
Yeah. Now, what would you describe? Our listeners have probably already tired of hearing us talk about Radford, but how would you describe Radford, Jason?
Just a nice little southern town, but I think it had a lot more going for it because we had a university in town, so we were kind of, we had a lot of culture around us, and we also had
extremely
Virginia Tech next to us, so we always had, like, we had a lot of cool stuff going on.
Yes, it was extremely sophisticated. There's not one, but two stores where you could buy Magic the Gathering cards.
Oh, yeah.
Somehow we couldn't support a CD store. The town was so – that was always kind of pathetic to me that even though there's like 8,000 college students there, there's no like continuous like CD store there the entire time.
At the height of the music industry in the 90s, we didn't have enough people to support.
There were quite a few attempts. And I remember like one bookstore – or actually two bookstores – in Radford tried to carry CDs, and it always failed. You always had to go to Blacksburg. You had to go to the Record Exchange.
And yet somehow we came out of Radford liking music.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know if you remember this, Jason, but I remember you were a little older than me. So I looked up to you. You're a hero of mine.
I invite you on the podcast and insult you to your face.
Jesus, Andrew.
So rude.
You're an old shit.
No, I'm saying you're one of my heroes. I think one of the first rock and roll concerts I ever went to was one of your band's rock and roll concerts. And
would that have been the Brothers Gore or DPW?
That would have been DPW.
It was a DPW band at the South Main Cafe there in Blacksburg.
Okay, I'll grant it that Andrew started off bad there, but then he turned it around. It felt like an insult and turned into an homage.
I remember a kind of like back alley black market deal that you and I were involved with around the year like 1996, where I was desperately trying to get my hands on all of the Weezer B-sides.
I remember that.
I was picking them up one at a time. I was trying to buy the singles. And I think it was you that had a CD of every... Did I sell it to you or did you sell it to me? Money changed hands and one of us sold a CD of burned Weezer B-sides to the other.
I think you gave me... I think I remember you going on the hunt for those Weezer B-sides. And I had a lot of them. Like I had the El Scorcho single that had, I think, Devotion on it, and you gave Your Love to Me Softly.
Oh, classic.
So
classic
stuff. You burned those off of that, and you made the disc, if I remember correctly.
What you're saying is I'm your hero.
You kind of are my hero. I mean, I had you gathered a lot of the materials from me.
But he put them in easy place.
You put them in one easy to listen place.
That's nice. Yeah.
But for music lovers of a certain era in a certain place, and that's this very small town of Radford, Virginia. I mean, you were the breakout star in 2001 because then you became you grew out your goatee. Like you do, to take on the mantle and nay the throne of being a classic rock DJ.
So, yeah, I was kind of like a hometown hero. It was really weird. She laughs at that, but it was really weird. Like, you know,
I'm sure
getting paid $8.50 an hour to talk about Foghat and Led Zeppelin and host like shows called The Big Hairball, which was all about hair metal.
You weren't paid $8.50 an hour. Is that true? $8.50 an hour. You're a star.
Oh, I know. And that's a thing. You would go to like BT's and people would come up to me and be like, oh, man, I can't believe I'm talking to Jason Gore. Like, you must
BT's
be rolling
is a
in the
really
dough.
Trashy. It's a really trashy college bar. Yes.
Think of the trashiest college bar and then go down like five levels and you have BT's. It's like, yeah, they would come up to me and they would be like, man, I can't believe it. Jason, I heard your voice from across the bar and I came right across. And I was like, that's Jason Gore. And I'm like, my God, you are rolling in the dough, aren't you? And I'm like, man, they don't even give me full-time hours.
That's how they snare you in this glamour industry of radio DJing.
That's the thing. You're getting paid for
exposure.
They hook
you with the promise of fame and glory.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
You probably get to like interview third-rate classic rock stars on the radio. They give you a special pair of sunglasses and then your butt is in the seat for forever. But you guys got it. But you got out.
I got out.
You got out while the getting was good. We kind of reconnected when you guys came to New York. Mm-hmm. You guys are in LA now, but you guys came to New York and you said, music, guess what? It sucks.
Yeah, I'm done.
We're comedy people now.
Yeah, I'm done rocking, guys. I'm all about the laughter. I stayed at your guys' place when we came up from Atlanta to find an apartment.
And do you guys know what he said about your place? I'm here to say it. You had a million couches.
Yeah, everybody said that. Everybody, whenever anyone talks about my apartment in 2006, they're like, man, you guys had a lot of couches.
But here's the thing. I didn't say it in any sort of like judgment.
No, it was marvel. Like, it was like, wow.
You should see the number of couches they have. It's like you guys held up an Ashley furniture.
What I would do for a couple of months when I first moved to New York City, I would find free couches on Craigslist. This was kind of pre-bedbug
scare. Right.
It wasn't pre, though. It was not pre.
There is no pre in New York. There is no pre-bedbug
scare. You were just living on the edge. You were living on the edge.
Yes, pre before I knew about it because I was so dumb and I was a rookie New Yorker. But I would pick up free couches on Craigslist. Uh-huh. And then this is also like before like iPhone cameras, and so I would have like I'd take pictures with like a nice digital camera, and I'd just repost the couches for sale. I would flip couches on Craigslist.
You flipped free couches.
Wow.
and a thing I learned really early on was you don't say like, hey, this couch is $300. I'll deliver it for $50. You just say $500 free delivery. You could just move those couches out the door, and the couches you probably saw circa 2008, 2009 were like the cream of the crop.
The ones you kept for yourself.
That I kept I was like, this
so,
I can't sell.
So I slept in your showroom is what you're saying.
Yeah.
What a treat. Wow. I can't believe you sold them. Never knew that.
I never knew that. That blows my mind.
This whole time, my impression was just that you were just hoarding all of these couches.
Yeah. Well, he was, but he was also running like the worst HGTV show ever.
there was like a couple weeks where we had like six or seven couches as we were flipping. Then it really did look like a showroom. But I think by the time you were there, we'd settled into just our normal amount, quote, normal amount of three couches for New York.
Well, I remember some being on like higher levels.
Yes. In order to reach one of the couches, the narrowest one, we set it up on blocks so it was in a double decker, like arena seating.
Yes. There's arena seating.
Arena seating couches.
The whole time I was like, why is this one so high? I can't reach that. There's no way I'm going to be able to reach that.
My whole impression of New York was like, we're going to move. Like, that's what you brought back to me. We're like, we've got to find an apartment and we're going to fill it with couches.
Like, we got to have a really high couch.
We got to have a low one and a high one.
I tell Kristen about the couches and she's like, honey, they're hoarders.
I did not
say
that.
They are hoarders.
It's absolutely normal to have a tall couch, a big couch, and then a love seat. Just an extra love seat.
Okay, well, that's enough about couches. We're going to talk about songs.
That is the most aggressive segue.
Until couches shut your couch mouth.
We're talking about Tom Brady and the Heartbreakers.
I'm basically dying to know, why is it that when we called you and said, do you want to punch up a song, why did you pick Won't Back Down?
Of all songs.
Of all songs.
And of all Tom Petty songs.
Well, I think that the reason, like, you guys presented this to us in terms of, like, picking songs that meant a lot to us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I didn't think of it as, like, a monstrous task to look at punching up a Tom Petty song, which, now that I am looking at it, is a little daunting, because Tom Petty was one of the greatest songwriters to ever live. Especially, I mean, for me, he's like top of the mountain. He's up there with, like, if you're doing a Mount Rushmore of people that really mean a lot to me as a, it's a very specific Mount Rushmore.
Sure.
If they are going to make it, but like
Jason people, Gore's Mount Rushmore Gore, of songwriters.
Right. Tom Petty is right up there for me. Like
Tom Petty, Bob Dylan, and Teddy Roosevelt.
I mean, Teddy. Oh man, that record he did with Van Morrison was pretty good. It was all anti-vax.
Is Van Morrison anti-vax?
Oh, he's very anti-vax.
What's happening?
He has like songs about it on his new record.
Oh God.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Him and Clapton.
We're way getting ahead of the eight ball. I think I want to play the opening verse of this song to put us in the mood. But basically, I was getting angry just listening to this song in preparation for today because I was just imagining it being played at an anti-vax protest, basically. So I can't believe I can't believe you brought it up about Van Morrison, although it is hateful that he is anti-vax and we're living in this timeline where we have to judge our previously beloved rock stars on their their foolish political stances. But that's where it has brought me with respect to this song. I will say that, like, only about 0.3 seconds elapses when you hear the opening muted guitar chunking along that you're utterly transported. I mean, it sounds incredible. It puts you in a place.
It's anthemic.
It's anthemic. I'm cruising down I-81 with the windows down.
For me, the only drawback of this song is that it's so anthemic that it's just so many morons have made it their anthem. If it comes on the radio, I'm incredibly excited. Any Petty song comes on the radio, I'm incredibly excited. But like Evan said, if you go to an anti-vax rally, walk by an anti-vax rally of morons, it's like there's a probability that this song is going to be on their playlist. It's like the list of terrible politicians that have been sent cease and desist by Tom Petty and his family for playing this at their rallies, you know, from George W. Bush to Donald Trump. It's just like it kind of has like a political rally like vibe to it because it is so anthemic.
Yeah. I've never taken it that way. I don't think I've ever even paid attention to it being played at any political rallies, mainly because it means so much to me personally that I might just like blank that out.
It's very personal. I think that there's something great and wonderful when they do get that cease and desist letter though. Like there's like, hell yeah. Like still,
oh, yeah.
Like the estate is still saying, fuck you, back down.
Well, I think the Trump administration got so many cease and desist that in the end they were only able to play like Gloria by Laura Branigan. Like that was literally what they would play. They were playing at the January 6th insurrection. They played that. They played Candle in the Wind.
They played Candle in the Wind.
They played Candle in the Wind at the January 6th. The original, not the Princess Di version.
But it's very personal to us. So for us, I think.
Hello, January 6th.
That song's not personal to us. this one is. We should talk about this one from their podcast that they have asked us to do. Okay. So it's very personal to us because, like in a very silly, weird way, when Jason's father died and we were driving home.
Down I-81.
Down I-81.
Nailed it.
We were driving from New York to Virginia, New Jersey to Virginia at that time. And we kept hearing the saddest songs possible. Like it just kept, Jason had to like drive and had to stay focused because I do not enjoy driving and I should have learned, but I didn't.
No, you don't need to.
not at that time. And we kept hearing like the saddest, I think like one of them was Elton John's My Father's Gun. I think that played.
Yeah. On like, of come all the on. Times for the two, for you hear a track like that off a Tumbleweed Connection and you're driving down and then like Q99 plays like My Father's Gun or a station like that where it's just like there's no warning.
A higher power was watching you and messing with you, to be sure.
Yeah, this, completely.
There's no other conclusion you can come to.
I think this song played after a really long period, a really long stretch of sad songs that we couldn't quite escape from.
Yeah.
And that felt like such a relief and a kindness from the universe.
And now we kind of take that because it was such a kindness in that moment of just like pure grief.
Yeah.
That when we hear this song like randomly on just like a station or something, or, you know, walking through a mall, we take it as like a good sign of good things to come.
Yeah, always. Because it became a major theme. So we had a show for a long time at UCB called the Dead Dads Club that was specifically about this experience. And
it's an incredible show.
Thank you. Of losing our dads within like a very short period of time, like that experience of grief and trying to find the comedy through grief.
And that was a sketch in the show about that car ride down to Radford.
Yes.
Where eventually we land on the radio playing like the top hit of the week was Taps.
Yeah, we did an exaggerated version of what really happened. What really happened was just like nothing compares to you as you drive down the road. Yeah. Like the fucking saddest thing. But yeah, so we did the show and it sort of that music and sort of him kind of we decided, I think it was your decision, Jason, to make Tom Petty the transition music for all of the sketches. So we would
The whole show was Tom Petty.
Yeah.
Because you owed him so great a debt. You're like, we'll just use his entire catalog in our show.
Yeah.
And also I feel like it's quintessential in the, and this is a compliment, dad music. Like I feel like that feels like a dad. Tom Petty feels like a dad.
Well, it was also something like one of those shows, there were only a handful of shows that I went to see with my dad. But we saw Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers in 95 in Charlotte and we saw them together. Cause he was one of those artists like Neil Young that we could both like relate to and listen to a lot together. And, so there was that weird connection there too.
He's still playing in the '90s. He's still having this great career, but he also has all these connections to the great artists of the '70s and previous generation. It's like he pulls it all together. I couldn't agree. Yeah. He has the best possible version of dad energy, you know. I will
yes, down. In the most wonderful way.
Yeah. I'm so picking you up from jail, sort of like, son. This is your last dance with Mary Jane. I'm sorry to say.
So it became a very personal thing, and like it's true. Like if Jason and I hear "Won't Back Down," if we hear Tom Petty in general, but especially if we hear that song, we're like, okay, this is a good sign.
Also, another thing about it is like when I used to visit Southern California and think about living here because we live here now. We live in Burbank. And I don't know why that was funny.
I think it's
funny to me because just moments ago, Kristen was saying how she's never going to get a driver's license and you just moved to LA. Yeah,
no. Well, I do have a driver's license, but I shouldn't use it is the thing. Right. And I did get a new one. Oh, I probably shouldn't broadcast this, I guess.
What?
To California authorities. But I did get my new one. But I'm just not to be trusted. I'm good on a country road and I'm good in a town.
Right.
But I'm not so good in a city.
This podcast also is huge with the LAPD, by the way. They're definitely listening.
Yeah, keep an eye on me. I take a lot of Ubers.
But one thing I would always think about, just to go back to what I was saying a little bit, what I would always think about visiting Southern California, I'd be like, yeah, Tom Petty lives here. I could live here. I don't know what that was, but it was like, this is the land of Petty, even though he's from Florida. But like, you know of Tom Petty being this California musician.
And he was your lodestar, your lighthouse.
He's kind of the ultimate Florida man, and yet he left that life behind And was just like this ultimate cool LA guy. He's hanging out with Stevie Nicks. He's hanging out with, you know, the Beatles that moved to LA, Ringo Starr.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know,
you're right. He's the ultimate LA guy.
Yeah.
But I really find him to just be like, I find Tom Petty to be like the ultimate cipher. If any Tom Petty song comes on the radio, I'm so happy. The windows are down. You somehow know the words, even though you don't know how you knew the words. You didn't expect to know the words. But it's like, I kind of knew nothing about Tom Petty. I kind of like understood nothing about Tom Petty until a couple years ago. I watched that documentary about him running down a dream, which is really great.
And,
although about 2 hours too long. And
it's like an 8-hour documentary.
Yeah. And it's just like, like what? He's from Florida? Like I had no idea. He's just like this. He's just like this rock star that exists and just churns out perfect hits.
But they could have said any state, right? And you would have been surprised.
Yes, like, Georgia, South Carolina,
Iowa?
Texas.
God.
Like yeah, sure. Tom Petty's from there.
I also remember listening to the, because that was from the Full Moon Fever record, which was big the summer of 1989. And I remember playing like Spotlight. Do you remember the game Spotlight?
Yes.
Did you guys ever play that?
Yeah, it's like,
you
mean tag, like, it's like
tag with flashlights.
With flashlights
out
tag
the woods?
With flashlight. Yeah. I would play that down on like Custis Street in Radford with like Foster Ridpath and all those guys. And everyone would be like, you listen to new Tom Petty?
Yeah.
Wow.
This
and
is
it
just
was good like,
old
it was
redneck
a cool
fun.
Thing. And I remember just being all over the radio that summer. And that was such a fun summer.
I forget how much older you are.
I'm so much older.
You already come to the table with his dad energy.
I didn't. It worked so well.
You brought the dad energy and then it was heightened by the Petty.
Yeah. You married dad energy.
I know I did. I did the best I could.
Mm. This is like, for me, like the number one, like any Tom Petty song is like, it's a song that it, if you put the lyrics of this song in front of someone, you know, you've never heard the song and you're like, read these lyrics. Is this song going to be good or bad? 100% of Tom Petty songs, 100% of Tom Petty songs,
right.
Someone would read and be like, this is going to be bad. Like no matter what the music to this song is like, it's going to be terrible. And with every Tom Petty song, you would be wrong. Every Tom Petty song is great.
You give them "You're So Bad."
You're familiar with it. Why
you give them the lyric? You give them the lyrics to "You're So Bad," and then someone would be like, "What? What is this? Like my sister's ex-husband can't get no lovin', walks around dog-faced and hurt."
Yeah, yeah. You just read it out unaffected. Though. She was an American girl.
This is a bad song. Where does the magic happen that takes dead on arrival lyric and makes it this brilliant? Even the first line, like, I won't back down, like, but there's something about the way he sings it. It has, like that sort of, like, staccato opening. Well, I won't back down. And, like, the long, the long back down is just so warm and, like, and the heart, I mean, this is this a... Jason, is this a heartbreaker song? This isn't a heartbreaker song.
This is not
song,
a heartbreaker song.
This is a solo
this
song.
This was the first solo record recorded, I believe, in... so Jeff Lynne from ELO produced it. I believe they recorded it in Mike Campbell's garage studio.
Okay, who's the...
So
who's
the record...
Who's the lead guitarist for the Heartbreakers?
Right. And also one of the main songwriters with Tom Petty.
Yeah.
So a lot of Tom Petty songs are either written by Tom Petty or they're written by Tom Petty and Mike Campbell. Yeah.
I mean, it does seem like a majorly, like, majorly elementary school mean friend thing to do, to be like, looking at the person on this album, Tom Petty is like, guys, I'm going to make my first solo album. This is not a Heartbreakers album. And then,
oh, and it pissed them off.
And then all of the Heartbreakers play on it, except for one. All of them play on it, except the drummer. It's
oh,
like,
that's
except for Stan Lynch.
You come play on it. Oh, the bass player. Why don't you come play on it? And the drummer just never gets the call.
He still doesn't know this album is out.
Which is crazy. Which is crazy because Stan Lynch of the Heartbreakers, one of the best. Like, you go back to and listen to any of those early Heartbreakers records, and he is clearly one of the best drummers around. He is such a solid in the pocket drummer.
Was it a personal thing?
It was a personal thing. Like they started to like not get along so much. Oh. And so when Tom Petty started working on the Wildflowers record, which is my personal favorite Tom Petty album, It was another situation where it's like, hey, Howie, come play bass. Hey, you know, Benmont, we need you on piano. Sure, yeah. We got this other guy playing drums.
But if
Mike's going to play guitar. And it was another one of those situations.
But if like Tom Petty is already a cipher, like who can name a single Heartbreaker? Like you can, Jason.
Oh, I just named them all.
And perhaps we can go there. But like, I think the average person on the street, if you were like, you know Tom Petty, you love his songs. Can you name one Heartbreaker?
And people would be like, yeah, Drew Barrymore.
It's just a whole other level of ciphers behind the cipher. But you have, I mean, you have a, as Liam Neeson would say, a particular set of skills when it comes to classic
rock. That's absolutely true. When it comes to classic rock.
Oh, yeah. When you want to talk about classic rock, I can sit and talk about classic. I mean, I was a classic rock DJ for 10 years.
It's your secret weapon.
So your knowledge of the Heartbreakers is just like, it's a couple notches above even the average music fans. You're a professional.
Yes, very much so.
He reads a lot of rock bios.
That's pretty much the only book I'll read. I'll read Dan Brown, just the dumbest book I can find.
Dan Brown rules. Dan Brown rules. Just own it. It
rules.
It's
the best. And I'll read the shit out of that and just rock bios. That's what I've read all my life.
That's your comfort.
Yeah. What's so funny about that comment, though, that I had it made in the shade at 105.3 The Bear is I was part time. I was making $8.50 an hour.
I mean, I know that they're using the hell out of you because they know it's a glamour position and they can pay you as little as possible. They made you do all the gopher stuff, I assume. You must
when I left that radio station, I was the highest rated show that they had on the station, and it was all pre-recorded. They wouldn't pay me to be live anymore. And they were just like, yeah, we can't believe that our pre-recorded show is the most popular show on the air here.
But one of the dividing lines, I think, when we started dating, I feel like your evolution was Jason used to do remotes where he would have to go and eat a lot of one type of food. And what was...
I went and there was this take and bake pizza place in Blacksburg, Virginia, where I had to like, it was an 8-pound pizza.
This is Diners, Drive-Thrus, and Dives, right?
They were and Dives, basically, maybe?
And Dives.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, and I had to like try to eat as much of it as I could against some former Marine who just did the whole thing in no time. I did 2 pounds of it, and all I could smell was sausage like a week.
They ask you to do something else.
They asked me to eat an 80-ounce steak.
And I said, really? Why? This was after we were dating.
Right.
And that was like sort of like, I think no one had ever asked you.
No,
really.
But they said if I ate the 80-ounce steak, they'd name it after me at
Texas
Roadhouse.
Is it worth it? Is it worth it to have the
and
Jason Gore?
Was like, I need to have you around. Please don't do this anymore.
Don't eat an 80-ounce steak.
It's worth it. If your name was on a plaque. Yeah. I feel like the main thing to say to the Texas Roadhouse is like, guys, this is the radio. Like, we can just say, we can say Jason ate the steak. We can do an hour on broadcast where Jason is like, oh, this is a hard
60 ounces.
And people will hear the promotion and come to the also Texas Roadhouse.
The thing about it too that's real shitty is it would have been featured at that Texas Roadhouse. It wouldn't be the whole chain.
Yeah.
So if I died, I'd just be remembered at that
in
Christiansburg.
Christiansburg, even.
Christiansburg, Texas Roadhouse, but nowhere else.
So that
all
was the
I'm screaming is sure. Jason knows that this was recorded in Mike Campbell's garage.
He
knows
had a life.
Who Mike Campbell is. But the average listener, even myself, you know, it's like it took me watching Running Down the Dream, the documentary, to be like, who is Mike Campbell? What? Mike Campbell is the genius guitarist for Tom Petty that wrote all these songs, but he's just like the man behind the curtain.
He's the man behind the curtain, but he was writing a lot of songs for other artists at that time. In fact, Boys of Summer is a Mike Campbell
song.
That's
a Mike Campbell
song. Didn't that piss people off?
That was a demo tape that he had given to Tom, and Tom was like, yeah, I don't think this is for me.
I love that song.
I do too. But when you listen to that song and think about Tom Petty singing it, you're like, oh, I can totally hear that.
Yeah.
It was such a huge hit. But yeah, I know way too much. When we get down to your point, Andrew, I know way too much about classic rock.
And that's why we have to kill you. My main beef with this song is that I
you would not listen to these lyrics and know what Tom Petty is ever backing down from. He's generalized it so that you can understand that he will never back down from anything.
Right.
Therefore, the song could be co-opted by a bunch of conspiracy theory addled crazies. But I'm willing to bet that you, rock bio aficionado, you know what he wrote this song about and what he didn't want to back down from.
But with the general don't back down, flash forward 15 years. Well, that's why we're invading Iraq, is because of this song. You know, you write this song because yeah. You're in some disagreement. You're in some disagreement with your record company, probably. Then 2003 is being played at rallies, and everyone's like, Tom Petty is right. We have to bomb Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, because you know the original title was Shock and Awe.
I can't believe I'm about to share a new piece of knowledge with you, person who is much, much more knowledgeable about this era of music than me. But right. Tom Petty's house was burned down by an arsonist in an apparent attempt to kill his whole family.
Yes.
The year before this song
it was on MTV News.
Came out. Yeah. This is very MTV newsworthy.
I mean, if there's one thing that should ever be on MTV News, that's it. Is
it was like the sounder was all and then Kurt Lee's like, I'm Kurt Loder and Tom Petty's house just burned down.
That's fucking terrifying.
It's utterly terrifying. This is the worst thing you can imagine. You're asleep in your home with the family, with kids and the whole nine yards, and it's set on fire. And of course, in that moment, he doesn't know why it's set on fire. He just gets out. Thankfully, nobody was hurt. They all live, but the house, you know, basically burned to the ground. And then come to find out through investigation, it was arson.
What?
Yeah. God. Yeah. That's fucking scary.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember that.
Horrifying.
So he wrote this song.
To
and
my
he
knowledge,
said that he thought that it would be too personal to catch on.
You know this, what? This, did he say that?
Mm-hmm. This song? Jesus.
There's nothing personal in the song. It's personal to him, but he didn't include any personal details.
He thought it was
details.
Too personal to him to catch on to anyone else. But the thing about it is, like,
because there are no identifying details. I know that you are saying that that is like a critique of the song, but that because it's not specific enough that it wait let me talk this is opening his mouth because you're saying that there's
Jason, for the sake of your marriage, back down.
Yeah, I'm gonna back down.
like because there are no identifying details, that's what makes it beautiful, because everybody can have this song. And yes, it sucks when Donald Trump uses this song. Yes, that blows. But all they have to do is send a cease and desist, and it's funny, and you move on with your life.
Do you think Donald Trump realizes Tom Petty's dead?
Yes.
I don't think he does.
Good question. No, he died during the Trump administration.
He has dementia too, right?
Yeah.
Trump, so who knows? He's living a different time.
Yeah.
And by two, I mean...
He's living a different time. He thinks Full Moon Fever just came out.
You know, here's a question for you, though.
And if Tom Petty walked in the room, he'd be like, Ivana?
How... My question for you is, how would one back down to a professional arsonist who had tried to kill your family?
I think reach out and you hand a box of matches.
Do you like
go into hiding,
you
like give up on your hope?
You're just like, that's me and my family will be homeless now.
Do you burn down your own house?
You
coat your new house in gasoline for them.
Yeah. It's just, I feel like doing anything is refusing to back down to an arsonist that tried to kill you, because...
I think there's probably more context here in terms of, like, you know, I think Tom at that point in his career was trying to write, he was excited about the songs that he was writing. He knew they weren't Heartbreaker songs. So I also think, just the house burning down is a piece of the puzzle. I think it's him showing that he won't back down in terms of his career and moving forward as Tom Petty and not necessarily needing the Heartbreakers at that point in time.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's his own personal anthem. And I can say, you know, sitting here as a person that now knows a lot more about the Heartbreakers than I did 30 minutes ago.
Yeah.
We know the arsonist to this date has not been found, and I think we're ready to point the finger at Stan Lynch, the drummer.
I was going to say, it's got to be Stan Lynch.
Right. He gets inducted into the Hall of Fame. 10 years later, the Heartbreakers kind of standing over to the side, looking awkward. Evan, will you give it back?
Why'd I get fired? And Tom's like, you know what you did.
I mean, I guarantee that's the LAPD's first phone call number one the next day. You know?
Yeah, well, before we hang up, Mr. Petty, can we get Stan Lynch's phone number?
So, Mr. Petty, again, this was a purported solo album, but you had all of the Heartbreakers except Mr. Lynch on it. You couldn't have them in for one track.
Back down.
all I want to say about that line, there ain't no easy way out. I think it's kind of underrated. You know, it's like no one would. I think a lot of people, like, everybody knows the lyric, I won't back down. It's through all the verses, but it's like, why isn't he backing down? Because there's no way out. It's so much more freighted and so much more like emotional to me than just like, I won't back down.
It's not just there's no way out. There ain't no easy way out. Yeah. There's a way out, like, but it ain't going to be easy. Mm-hmm.
If you take the easy way out, bad things are going to come.
His back is up against the wall, but he's not going to back down. There's just so much more. I think that line's underrated. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Oh! It hurts. Who's playing the guitar? Is that Harrison?
It's Harrison.
The slide guitar is Mike Campbell.
Oh, really? I thought it was Harrison.
George Harrison's only playing acoustic guitar and backing vocals on this.
Wow. That's got to be stressful to be in your garage studio playing slide guitar while George Harrison is just looking at you.
Yeah.
Just staring at you.
Yeah. The master of the slide guitar.
Yeah.
There are two people that are like the best at slide guitar. George Harrison, Dwayne Allman.
Yeah.
Three people. Mike Campbell.
And Mike Campbell. Jason, I have to say, you're putting yourself in danger of like becoming like a podcast lifeline that we're going to call up at any given moment when we're recording. Like,
yeah,
who was playing acoustic guitar?
Like, hey, guys, what are we talking about today? Mississippi Queen by Melvin? Great. Well, the song Mississippi Queen.
So the lyrics on that verse is, well, I know what's right. I got just one life in a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I'll stand my ground.
That's deep, man. One life.
Yeah.
You got to make do right now with that one life.
Well, you only have one life.
His life was so short, too.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And it was just threatened by an arsonist, probably Stan Lynch.
Another thing I think we need to mention too is this was co-written by Jeff Lynne.
Yes, of ELO.
Of ELO.
At this point in Petty's career, the boundary between who is a Tom Petty or Heartbreaker versus ELO versus a Wilbury is getting so hazy.
Yes.
George Harrison and Jeff Lynne and Tom Petty are on like each of their records, and eventually they just merged into this supergroup where they even pretended they weren't a supergroup. They're just going to be George Harrison's backing band or something like that. And then finally we're just like, well, we're all just hanging around together anyway. We'll just make a whole record.
They called, if I remember that story correctly, like Harrison called him over to sing backing vocals on a new single called Handle With Care, and they liked it so much that they decided to make the Wilburys out of it. Hmm. But they weren't credited as Tom Petty or George Harrison on the record. They all had their own individual Wilbury name.
I have this vivid memory as a child, like driving through Radford, talking to my dad about rock and roll, like you do. And he was explaining the Traveling Wilburys to me. In retrospect, I think I thought the Wilburys were like a 70s thing. This is like concurrent with when the Wilburys exist in like 1990. That it's like,
oh yeah,
it's like, okay, like, so there's this band, George Harrison from the Beatles is in it. Okay, I know the Beatles. I like them, even though I'm 8 years old. Like, you know, Bob Dylan is in it. Tom Petty is in it. Like, Roy Orbison is in it.
Yeah.
He probably didn't know Jeff Lynne was in it. It's just something you know. But Jeff Lynne's in it. And I think
Jim Keltner was the drummer.
And I was like, so this is like, all these guys are in this band.
You could say
like,
any name there, I would nod.
I was like, all these guys are in this. Like this.
Woody Wooderson was playing tambourine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Woody Wooderson. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Woody Wooderson. He's good.
But I said to him, like, wouldn't this be like, this is like the best band of all time. And there was kind of like a long pause in the car. And Dad was just sort of like, no. No, they're not very good. And just like, as an 8-year-old, I just couldn't understand this, that you put together all these titans of rock and roll, and it's just like, no, Handle With Care is pretty good, but that's it.
They are a medium band. This band is strictly medium.
No, they're mostly just, they're just dicking around.
That makes no sense.
You'd think they would be the greatest band in the world.
That's really funny.
But honestly, those records rule, man. They're so good. Like Handle With Care, End of the Road.
Sure, Jason.
They're great. Let's get on the phone line. Let's get your dad on this.
No. I think that's true because I think like to be the best, you have to have somebody on there that's fine. You know what I'm saying?
That's just fine.
Yeah.
So what, they could have had Carrot Top on there and it would have been better?
No, I just think they have too many stars on there.
Right.
Yeah, if you have something with too many stars in it, it's not going to be as good.
So they should have had Rick Springfield.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, you know, if you put Tom Brady and Cam Newton and Terry Bradshaw all in a team, do you have a good football team now? No.
No, you need somebody fine. And I can't speak to who that would be because I don't know anyone that you just mentioned.
You need someone who's like a glue to the band, who like, if they were slighted, might burn down your house. And that's kind of the friction that holds your group together.
Yeah. I think that's true.
How's this finish, Evan? Did they just fade out there at the end? Is it just a fade or is this a big finish?
Are you talking about this episode or are you talking about this song?
I'm talking about the song.
We're going to fade and the song fades too.
We have a very brief fade. Tom Petty is known for his short songs, getting to the chorus quickly and getting out. I think we have a short fade here. Here it is. Oh, no.
Okay, they played a note.
Yeah.
Big diamond.
They did it.
A diamond on that big chord. Okay.
They played a diamond, which is Nashville parlance for a whole note. Something I learned.
Do you guys, when you guys are recording music, do you use diamond a lot?
Well, we sort of had it. We used to play with like our own band members when we would tour, which we're basically not doing anymore. But we'd play with like friends of ours who were more like working musicians that they would play with, you know, 20 artists and then come play with us. So then they are bringing their own lingo as like touring musicians to us. And we're learning from them. And it'd
That's
be like,
so
like,
funny.
And it's all about the shorthand, like the quickest way to write the chart down in your own musical shorthand to like not waste time making notes. Like we all want to just play the song. Okay, a whole note's just a diamond. Okay. What are the chord changes? Instead of like writing notes, you would literally write shorthand like, okay, this song is freaking simple, man. It's just a 1645. And that means it's a 4-bar phrase of a 1 chord followed by a 6 chord followed by a 4 chord followed by a 5 chord.
This is raising questions for me though, because why is it faster to draw a diamond than a whole note, which is a circle? Seems like the circle would be faster than the diamond.
Yeah. I don't get that.
You
got to
make the right turns on the diamond.
I don't know. I think every like show, every industry, everything has their own sort of lingo, and that becomes cool.
I think that if I was playing with musicians like that, I would just turn into a monster and just be like, just fucking end it. Like, I don't need to know what it is. Like, I would get so enraged, I would burn down someone's house.
Yeah.
I don't even know. I don't need to know if it's a whole load. Look at this guitar. It looks like this.
That's all it is. That's all it is, man.
The petty question here I have about the song in general is, are any of the three of you familiar with this? I think I learned it from the documentary, which, like I already said, is great, Running Down the Dream. Tom Petty, in his songwriting, he talked about a concept 30 seconds to the chorus. Have you guys heard him talk about this, Tom Petty, in interviews or anything? Where he just said that he always wanted in his songs to get to the chorus within 30 seconds.
I have heard that, yeah.
Which is like such
a... I haven't heard that.
Yeah.
And honestly, I agree with it.
That's good philosophy for everything, of every piece of art.
Yeah, just get to it. You know, you'd only need one verse, but weirdly, like when I was listening through to this, it's like, it kind of takes a while to get to the big, hey, baby, the first one. It's kind of two
rare case. This is a rare case of Petty putting two stanzas up front instead of getting to the chorus inside 20, 30 seconds. Because he wants you to know, not only will he not back down, but he's also going to stand his ground.
Yeah.
So it's important to get in all those lines up front before he drops. And also, he's not going to be turned around.
I guess that's why when you think about the song, you think about not backing down and not about how there ain't no easy way out, is because it took him more than 30 seconds to get to the chorus.
I'm thinking of some other Tom Petty songs like that, like the waiting takes a little bit to get to that chorus. Yeah. But when it powers in, you're like, it was good that I waited that 40 seconds for that chorus.
Yeah,
say something about this particular song, though?
Please, please. Mm-hmm, please.
I think this is a rare song where the chorus isn't necessarily the most anthemic part. Like, I think when we think of I Won't Back Down, we think of I Won't Back Down, like right from the get-go. That's what I'm thinking of when I think
of
it.
So you think that the verse is so powerful that
I think so.
The chorus is just there to like serve as a celebration of what just happened.
It is the exclamation point. It's not like the crux of it.
I think that's exactly right. The "Hey Baby" that comes at the top of the chorus is just a release. It's a celebration. Yeah. It's a chance to get this emotional lift. Hey baby, you know it has. Yeah. It's just an explosion after you just declared with your finger in some guy's face. I won't.
Yeah.
And like, damn.
And that's like every Tom Petty chorus. Every Tom Petty chorus is just like, well, let's just sing a really high note. And like, it's almost like with the lyrics thing. Like if you explained the music writing of Tom Petty's song, it'd be like, well, that's a little repetitive. Maybe mix it up, Tom. But it's like, no, every time it's perfect.
Yeah.
And also to talk about like the, like getting that kind of like explosive feeling in the chorus, you have like that really palm muted guitar all through the verse, and then you're just like really opening up the instruments and letting loose once you hit the chorus.
That's where like those, you can hear those Harrison acoustic guitars just power through, like really strong on the chorus, just open chords.
Yes, massive rhythm with guitar just carrying you through. I love
many
that.
Many diamonds.
Yeah, only one
diamond at the end. Just end the song.
Now, Jason, Evan and I have been running briefly a mini segment about let's say trivia, let's say, some of these videos.
I really thought we were going to skip it this week.
Just call it trivia.
I thought about skipping it this week because we've been doing it early in the episodes, but I just feel like this is a really great opportunity for me to embarrass Evan yet again.
I hate this because I get killed every week. And we've already established that Jason is a fount of music trivia, especially about this genre.
Oh, don't worry. Yeah. I could blow this, guys. I could easily blow this.
The question is, that Evan could earn $5 on Venmo here, but my guess is going to be Jason. Maybe Kristen comes in as the dark horse. Who's playing drums?
She might.
Who's playing drums? Not in the actual recording studio, but in the music video for this song.
Oh, that's easy. It's Ringo Starr.
Ringo Starr.
Wow. Wow. Okay. I owe you $5.
But he also played on the song too.
You know what's crazy? I would have guessed Ringo Starr as a joke, because I would think, who do I know that's a drummer? And that would have been the one.
But wasn't he also just playing like, he wasn't even playing drums. He was playing like a globe, wasn't he?
I think he was in there as basically a joke. Like you would have guessed him as a joke. And also he was a joke in life at that point. So he appeared in the video. It's like tapping on a globe. He looks in the globe and he sees himself and goes, wow. It's the whole thing is a goof.
And just very like Southern LA. Like, who's in town? Oh, Ringo's in. Like, get him to set.
Yeah, I saw Ringo over at Stevie Nicks' place last week.
I'm looking at it right here. Ringo Starr played drums in video. He was not on the song. Phil Jones played drums on the song.
Who is that?
Do you still get $5 on Venmo?
Yeah, you guys still get $5 on Venmo.
Oof, golly, stakes are high.
So Phil Jones was Del Shannon's drummer.
My little runaway, that guy?
Yeah, which in a funny thing about Del Shannon is when Roy Orbison died...
No sentence has ever started that way.
They thought about continuing the Wilburys even longer, and they were going to replace him with Del Shannon.
This is dizzying.
Roy Orbison donate his eyes? Am I confusing him with someone else?
You're thinking of Jerry Orbach.
Jerry Orbach. Oh, thank you.
A lot of people do confuse Jerry Orbach with Roy Orbison.
They have a lot of, the letters in their names are very similar.
Oh, okay. You mean for somebody to see?
Yeah,
why do like I, somebody's walking around like these eyes? They
not,
went dirty
not
dancing.
To a museum.
Yeah, he didn't donate his eyes.
I thought it was to science
fun.
Or something, or to like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Why do we both know that about Jerry Orbach?
I guess it's because of that commercial that comes on, the person that got Jerry Orbach's eyes.
Yeah, I got Jerry Orbach's eyes.
That's real. That exists
in
New York.
That was his cause.
You
hear it. He had like a nonprofit that was his like life's work, was giving eyeballs out.
I'm glad. I don't think I would give mine.
Nobody slates baby's eyes for somebody.
Now, the one other thing I will say about just Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers in general is that when I got a little deeper into them 10 years ago through, as I mentioned numerous times, this great documentary.
Well established at this point. Thank you.
Running down a train.
I will say... If you were thinking about not watching it after I've, just roundly suggested it.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to watch it. Now you talked about it so much, I don't want to watch
it. The real reason you need to watch it is you just have never seen such scintillating divorced dad fashion. Just like everyone in the Heartbreakers around the time Full Moon Fever is getting made, is getting a divorce.
Yeah.
This movie's made in the early 2000s, and just like looking at the band on stage, they're still just absolutely shredding. Mike Campbell is up there. Like, just sounding so amazing, but you can just look at all of them and just be like, these are all men who've just been unleashed from like 20-year plus weddings and like are dressing themselves so wildly. Even Mike Campbell is playing, if I recall, a guitar with the University of Florida Gator on the guitar.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, if you have a wife, your wife's like, no, yeah, no. Like Mike.
They've been suddenly set free.
The whole stage.
No one should advise
them. The whole stage is one big midlife crisis.
Yeah. I always thought that Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers kind of dressed like, from that point on, the divorced dad uniform from like 89 through the end of Petty's career. Yeah. They all kind of dressed like they were Lost Boys in the movie Hook.
Yeah. They're like, yes.
It's like a little pirate thing going on.
Yeah. And a little bit of the Scarecrow from Batman.
Yeah.
It's like Tom Petty puts on his like signature hat and you're like, the Scarecrow?
Wait, is there straw coming out under
that? That is so funny. Was he single at that point?
No, he was married.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I do think you get to a point in every marriage where just like, it's going to be what it's going to be. You know?
Yeah.
I've been there.
I love that she said that and looked directly into my eyes.
Just say, he's wearing shorts right now that once said Reebok and now say Book.
Bach.
I will say that Mike Campbell's love of the Gators is not just something he's flaunting. I have a little inside info about this. He truly loves the Florida
What's
Gators.
The deal?
Sure.
It isn't just on his guitar. I once was so lucky, thanks to a Radford connection, to walk across the stage right before they went on at a Fleetwood Mac concert. We're talking, I'm on the stage 5 minutes before Stevie Nicks is taking the stage.
And wow.
Actually, a friend of ours from Radford.
This will mean nothing to anyone else, but just to Jason. Christopher King, Emily and Katie's little brother, ran monitors for Fleetwood Mac.
He mixes Fleetwood Mac's
monitors.
Oh my
God.
It's crazy. So he walked us across the stage, and Mike Campbell is now their guitarist.
You know, right.
They do a couple
with Neil Finn.
They do a couple Tom Petty songs. It's amazing. His entire setup at his like little guitar station covered with Florida Gator shit. Just like all of his guitar picks are on like a Florida Gators mouse pad, which first of all is very smart to keep your guitar picks on a mouse pad. So easy to pick up. But like this is a guy who just lives, eats, breathes Florida Gators. He's walking out on stage with Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Nicks, and the last thing he's like, okay, time to center myself. You know, play 2 hours of Fleetwood Mac hits, Florida Gators. That's the last thing he wants to think about before he starts playing. Just raging.
Oh, God, I love that.
It's good to love something.
I love that so much.
Oh, it's so pure.
His love of the Gators is like Little Steven's love of scarves. When I went backstage, 2003, the East Street, Springsteen East Street Band Show in Richmond, because 105.3 The Bear was one of the first stations to play Little Steven's Underground Garage. So we were able to go back and hang out with him. Scarves galore. I have never
not
seen so many scarves in my life.
It's not like, he's like, well, I have to wear the scarf now because it's my thing. It's like,
no, it's the way of life. It's like, if he doesn't see a scarf, he is underpowered.
Probably in his rider.
And we're backstage, and Steve Gore, who you guys know very well.
Unrelated
as well.
To you. Unrelated to you. Just different
cousins. But we told everyone we were brothers. We're backstage, and this is one of the greatest moments of rock and roll I think I've ever heard. And Steve says to Little Steven, he's like, yeah, Steve, Little Steven, you know, you're doing this meet and greet before the show. Aren't you exhausted by the time you get to the stage? And Steve, like, it's like all of the air sucked out of the room. And Little Steven turned to Steve and said, tired? There is no tired. The stage is a sanctuary.
That's so nice.
And we were like, oh my God, he's right.
He's right.
But there is tired. There is tired.
You can't be tired. The stage is a sanctuary.
They're so tired.
Yeah.
But I do think it's true that you do get energy when you go on stage. I guess that's
true. Oh, completely.
Oh, boy, he blessed you in that moment.
Yeah.
You didn't try, like, just taking the scarf away just to see what would happen, right? Just like he would power down like Iron Man.
We were back there with contest winners for 105.3 The Bear.
Sure.
And some idiot spilled his beer on, like, the table scarf. And I have never seen, like, it must have been, like, Little Steven's manager who just, like, silently lost his shit in the corner. Which is like, like, knowing that he was going to be, like, sucking the beer out of that scarf while Little Steven was on stage.
Yeah,
so it was perfect for the next show.
It's like he's just cast the ring into the fiery volcano at the heart of Mount Doom.
Yeah.
I feel like we have taken the longest ever diversion from your personal story about driving down interstate.
Oh my God.
81, which you
Are
probably forgot we were talking
to still
about.
Be talking about that.
I didn't want to close our, I did not want to close our time together talking about this song before at least giving you a chance to revisit that.
It's, well, yeah, I think, I don't know. I just think what it's become over the course of time is that, is this sign from above, from the universe, from wherever, that wherever we are is the right, exactly the right place. And it's okay. When I think about like the first, well, here's the random time. When we were writing that show, it took forever. It took forever. We started writing about 5 years after like the experience of losing our parents. So like, I think it took a long time for us to get there to be able to write it.
We had also done some other shows at UCB that didn't quite hit.
Yeah.
And I think that the reason we figured that they didn't hit is because we needed to be doing comedy that was more personal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think the type of comedy that we do, especially Kristen, comes from a, because I do a lot of dumb stuff.
But you do things that are, that's personal
but
to
I
you.
I do a lot of stuff that is personal too. Yeah. Like I
being
I
stupid kind of feel like is personal to you.
For both of us, the best comedy comes from
the truth.
The truth.
But we were, so we had written the show. I don't know if you remember this, Jason, because you don't seem to remember it at all.
Let's find out.
We had written the show. We had done. We had finally at the time, like UCB Operations Brigade got. An audition show, and it was really, really hard to get those things.
Called The Spank.
It was called The Spank. The things that we desperately hope for that right. have gone away. But we had gotten the state, and it was a real big deal. And Jason and I, our goal when we got married was to visit all 50 states. Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember that.
And so our getting this show kind of coincided with a trip to Hawaii, which was our final state.
Yes.
And we went to Hawaii and we got there and we find out that our director and one of the lead people, Michael Hartney, had gotten Just for Laughs, right? It was Just for Laughs, right?
It was an audition for Just for Laughs at that point in time,
yes.
I think.
Yeah. Which happened to happen the day that we had been given the spank. And so they had emailed us and said,
we'd have to reschedule.
And for the listeners, the spank is like you get a sketch show, but you just get to do your sketch show once. And it's like an audition once, yeah. to get the recurring sketch show, which is exactly. very coveted. Yes. So it's a high stakes date that you finally booked.
That yeah. we finally got after.
That we've worked so hard to get to that point. And also like in that point in time, like UCB was pretty hard on shows getting runs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So even to get the spank, you're like, oh God, we can't blow this.
Can't blow it. It was a big deal. It meant a lot to us. And then to find that our lead actor had gotten this incredible opportunity and was no longer available, there was the risk of losing that date completely and not giving us another date. That was part of it.
And then Lauren Adams had gotten Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had to reschedule a ton of things because of the amazing, you know, our actors were getting incredible opportunities. Yeah. And
right, so like, you're like cheering them on. Up. Everyone's happy about this, and yet you guys are left here. So, I mean, I have to ask you, did you back down?
Well, we didn't. We rescheduled. Well, we emailed and accepted that we would have to reschedule that day.
Reschedule.
But do you remember walking outside? I
don't remember this.
You do not remember this.
No, hit me.
So we were in Hawaii. We were in Honolulu and we left the hotel and that song was playing outside. Do you not?
I do remember that now.
And it was like a sign that it's okay. Like give room to other people to be successful right now. Do not stress. It's going to be okay. And it was. And then we got the run when we actually were able to do the show a month later. But still today, I feel like if we hear that song, it's a really, really amazing sign. We hear it all the time. Like, I don't know. Like, I'll be going in for a meeting.
We only listen to Tom Petty radio on Sirius XM.
Well, yeah, that helps. That's going to help.
And they play
you.
It at least 8 times a day.
Then that means that every day is a good sign.
Right.
But no, if we hear it out in the world, if we hear it, like, you'll hear it in a mall. You'll
if
hear
I'm
it
in, like, a Del Taco.
I think an outdoor mall is the perfect place to hear this song. And it's like, you know what? I was meant to go into this Sephora, you know? I was meant to buy this thing.
Yeah. So that's why the song has always been, you know, from doing that show, from that experience, because I kind of feel like that was the one experience that just really like completely started our comedy careers in like a serious way.
I mean, this song, it seems so central to you all. It seems like almost like a holy anthem to you all. And that is why I'm so glad that you've told us to improve it. You know,
let's make it even better.
To take this song, it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
It's a pretty good song.
And we're going to take our conversation here. We're gonna walk away for a little bit. It might be a couple hours, might be a couple weeks, and we're gonna bring you back a version that is irrefutably better just absolutely
punched up.
It's not
that it's completely precious to us in this moment.
You're going to be putting the Dead Dads Club back up in Los Angeles at the UCB LA, mm-hmm. if it still exists. Just so you can use our version of the Tom Petty song.
Great. That's good. I would like that.
I'd like to hear that.
Okay. We'll, we'll be back after this.
Let's punch it.
Punch it!
Okay, we went away during the break, and we have punched up this song based on our discussion. What we learned in talking to you guys is that this song, I Won't Back Down, is at the core of your very relationship.
At the core of your very emotional center.
This song is at the emotional heart of your tender, tender love for one another, and what we sought to do here in punching it up is effectively to take that away from you by ruining it.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. That's
good.
Great.
That's wonderful. Good. And I also don't think that there's anything tender about us. So I think that's appropriate. It's good.
You know, one problem that we identified as we were chatting, some might say it's a problem, is how general this song is. You can apply it to anything from your relationships to, say, invading Iraq. And we thought maybe we could help things out by getting down to brass tacks and getting a little bit specific.
So I'm confident that, you know, obviously this has emotionally powered your relationship for upwards of 10 years, but I'm pretty sure that after you hear this one, you'll never listen to the original again. And even if it comes on the radio, you'll just charge out of whatever mall or food court you're in just to listen to this one. We will email you an MP3. Don't
please
worry.
Do.
But not
please
an AFE,
do.
Not an AFE, though. It's not, you know.
Yeah, and I will listen to it in the food courts that you think I frequent.
Everyone's doing that after 2020, right? Everyone's still going to food courts, right?
Yeah. I can't wait to get back in.
Oh, I can't wait to get those samples again.
Holy smokes.
Oh, man, that's going to be good.
That's like a 2024.
Okay, guys, here you go. Without further ado, I Went Back Down part two.
It was probably Stan. It was probably Stan. You can tell me it was a random fan, but it was probably Stan. There's no fingerprints. Cops want evidence. But I know deep down the arsonist was Stan Lynch. He was Stan Lynch. Fire Marshal. The motive is crystal clear. A heartbreaker tried to destroy my career. Then he did disappear. Now we can't find Stan. He's gone on the lam. But seems suspicious he got a tattoo on his hand of a gasoline can. For real, a gasoline can. Hey, Your Honor. You want a problem? Invite him to Mike Campbell's garage. He turned to sabotage.
I'm so tired of crackpot bullshit.
Yes.
Won't you show me you're still the same old Tom?
We miss our friend Troy, baby. Give me more lip. We'll be 6 feet underground, and I won't back down.
Oh shit!
And I won't back down.
Oh my god!
That was excellent.
Oh, that was
my
it.
God.
Sabotage and garage. I've never heard that rhyme in a song before. So I love it.
It's just so I'm clear. It's Fire Marshal.
Fire Marshal
is the first course. So, and then it's, hey, Your Honor.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. I mean. Oh.
And then we, as the thing spooled out, mm-hmm. we didn't really plan this going in, but as we got to a third stanza, it seemed obvious that Tom was really out on a limb here, our imagined version of Tom. And so Roy stepped in with some beef, trying to correct things.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, mostly Evan and I ended up getting in a little bit of a logical argument about how Tom Petty seemed to be mixing up in this version of I Won't Back Down
right.
the concept of probable cause with the concept of a motive. Does Stanlich have a motive? Definitely. He right. was invited to Mike yeah. Campbell's garage. Is there a probable cause? Maybe not. But on a deeper level, we were like, well, Tom Petty's not a lawyer.
Yeah.
It makes sense for him to be getting the two things mixed up. And that's
unhinged.
The sort of thing
it's
that okay. Roy would get pretty mad about at a Heartbreakers rehearsal. Or not, excuse me, not a Heartbreakers rehearsal, a Wheelerberry's rehearsal. He would say like, Tom, come on, let's get this together.
I do wonder, though, is this true? Is this factually true that Stan Lynch has a gas can on his hand?
That may have been an invention.
It's weird you ask because no one has seen him since the day Tom Petty's house broke.
Yeah.
That is true.
And I guess, I mean, let me put the question to you.
Right.
The rhyme between Lynch, Stan and gasoline can, coincidence?
It's pretty good evidence. It's right there in front of you.
It's right there in front of you.
If I was on this jury, I would be like, Lynch did it when you went away to do this song minutes ago. I will say that I had hoped it would go down the Stan Lynch path. And I'm also just going to go out on a limb here, even though the original song meant a lot to us. Version number two means even more.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's personal. That reminds me of my dead dad.
Yeah. I mean, me too. Me too. My dad was fiery. He'd probably burn down a place. If he were here.
I mean, a better compliment we could not have received. My sincere hope for you is this song puts the thrill in the next 10 years of your marriage.
Oh, my God.
It better.
That's why we did this podcast. Sake.
It better. Literally, yeah, we're like, we got to do a podcast together to save this marriage.
We need to save the spark.
Guys, that's the punch. We will send it to you because as our honored guests, mm-hmm. you get a copy of this for posterity, and we're going to take a break and come back with your walk-in music.
This is so nice. Thank you so much. Is this in lieu of getting paid? Just checking.
I wouldn't say it's in lieu of being paid. I would say it's a payment.
It is a payment.
It is a payment.
Worth more than its weight in gold.
I would agree.
Thank you.
Just for the Woolbury breakdown alone.
Yeah, this is a major you're welcome situation.
I will take it.
Let's punch it.
Kristen, Jason, it has been a joy to have you, and we will be emailing you the MP3 of our punch up so that, you know, now presumably when you want it to like turn around your emotional mm-hmm, vibe, you won't want to listen to the Tom Petty version.
Right.
You'll want to listen to our version.
To the punched up version for sure.
So
whenever you send it to us, it will be a sign that whatever we're doing is exactly the right thing.
Yes. And if it comes on like in a store, like a Sephora, just run out of the store and listen to ours on your phone.
Mm-hmm. Or I'll just keep it on a flash drive and like hand it to the desk and be like, can you play this?
Every time we email you this song, it's going to be that like that little white feather from Forrest Gump floating by in the breeze.
Yes.
Well, but
I would actually appreciate that. I'm always looking for a good sign.
I think if you tell the people behind the desk to do it in the 105.3 the bear voice, though, I think you'd have a lot more success.
Is there any way you could play this song off of a flash drive from the... This is a better version of Tom Petty's I Won't Back Down. It's on a flash drive right here from my hand, Jason Gore,
105.3
The Bear.
Meet you down at the Sheeler Motor Mile.
We'll be hanging out at the Sheeler Motor Mile from 1 until 3.
Kristen, is Robbie that just Rags a thing that you know
dogs,
about?
So make sure you're going out there.
I'll be eating 100 corn dogs in 1 hour. Really?
I will die today at the Sheeler Motor Mile before 3 p.m.
I won't be thinking it, even though I could. So we like to wrap up the show with a little segment we like to call walk-in music. It's where you guys share a song that just you think really captures your vibe when you're like walking into it, into like a special event. It could be you're a closing pitcher walking into the stadium, mm-hmm. Game 7 of the World Series. It could just be a party you're walking into.
Like, so, for example, the original I Won't Back Down has very high Sir This Is a Wendy's energy. That could be your walk-in music when you're about to speak to the manager.
But you guys have sent us your walk-in song. We got it queued up. We're going to play it. We just want you guys to walk us through what sort of event you're walking into, what your vibe is. We want to hear it all.
I'm dropping it in right now.
Oh, the classic.
It's a bunch of British people stomping on some church boards.
I think we're walking into Orion's.
Yeah, we're walking into Orion's and we're like, we want your best table, Ryan's. Can I talk to Ryan? Is Ryan here? No, this is so when we did sketch comedy together for years as Bridge and Tunnel in New York City, we had a running show at the Pit, the People's Improv Theater. We had a monthly show there for like five years.
Speaking of, RIP.
RIP again. Another one down.
Another good one gone down.
And this was like when the sound person, the tech person was announcing us, this would be our music. We would run out on stage to We Will Rock You for every Bridge and Tunnel show.
And the crowd and would go flipping wild.
Speaking of the stage is your sanctuary, this song would bring back the energy that we needed to have that we had lost from working full-time day jobs, I think.
Yeah, like we go there and then you go downstairs at the Pit, which was just like a very weird green room. Did you guys ever do a show at the Pit?
I did, and it's a fetid dungeon.
Yes, there's like a weird green screen area. There's a lot of gym equipment from the owner.
Collection of old couches.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, collection of the worst.
Six couches.
Six couches where you're like, these definitely have bed bugs.
We would wash our clothes as soon as we left. We would take our clothes off as we were walking in the door.
There was always like some sort of stuffed animal just creeping you out in the corner. But we would go in there and we would pump ourselves up. And then the moment we heard the, you know, the boom, boom, clap coming out, and we would have, you know, we would pack the downstairs area.
Oh, yeah.
And like
anywhere
everyone's freaking out.
Anywhere from 3 people to 30.
Anywhere from 3 to 30 people, yes. and I don't know. It just, there's nothing like it that just puts you right into the only other song, like after we started doing other shows kind of post Bridge and Tunnel, the song that I think pumps us up these days the most is I'm Still Standing by Elton John.
Yes.
But those are the two like pump up songs for us
this
right
is
now.
Like We Will Rock You is pure.
We Will Rock You is pure. Like you're going out on stage.
We Will Rock You is
show.
Pure energy.
Still
period.
Standing has lived a life. Like yes. It's like, okay, you've been around, you're doing this for a long time.
Yes.
Yeah.
We Will Rock You is like, I have hope.
We Will Rock You as very stage as a sanctuary. Give a damn show.
Yes. I'm entering the stage, my sanctuary, where I draw all of my power. The crowd bursts to their feet when they hear that song. Basically, I'm trying to give you guys a trophy here because you've picked the perfect walk-in song. And I hereby declare that no one else can guest on this show and pick We Will Rock You. You guys can own that.
Yeah, everyone else should be embarrassed they didn't pick it. And the best part is that this is not even a figurative pick for you guys. You guys aren't saying, like, if only there was an event someday at which we could use the song.
Well,
like,
years,
no.
Years of this
we
song.
We use this every week for 5 years because it's clearly the best.
Yes, we would use it.
Song.
We would use it for the intro song for every show. We did. We started doing a show called Get Real, where we would interview like psychics and actors and stuff. And we would interview them, get their stories, and then do a sketch show based on their lives. And even then, the interstitial music, like from interview back into the show, was the fast version of We Will Rock You. So we were mixing it up.
And that's just where you put on the 45 and turn it up to 78 or what?
Oh, no. There is a fast version. It's called We Will Rock You Fast. And it's kind of like a punk rock version of We Will Rock You.
By Queen?
By Queen. Kicking your can all over.
This is the sort of 105.3 The Bear classic rock DJ knowledge that we're just behind the eight ball.
Dare I say it, our podcast has been punched up. Now we Andrew and I so just even enjoyed, before even knowing what song you're bringing in, enjoying the idea of a couple's walk-in song that we've decided that we're just going to join you. We had to think of what is our couple's walk-in song just as a duo. So, now, the specific event that we were kind of thinking of, rather than, you know, like coming out on a stage or for a performance or, you know, welcoming, this is sort of like, this is our brawling song, we decided. If Andrew and I ever needed to like go into a bar fight, say like if you knew in advance for some reason that you had to do a bar fight, this is how... Right. This is how we want to burst through the swinging saloon doors.
Because whoever you're going to be fighting with, you want them to know you're coming. You're going to be like, hey, guys, you know that fight that maybe was going to happen?
Here we come.
Here we are.
Put up your dukes.
Because we're so good at fighting, and we fight so
often. Right, you guys are the best
fighting. I don't think either of us has ever been in a fight in our life, except
okay,
with
this
each
is,
other.
This is not necessarily a deep cut, but we'll say a medium cut from the band The Allman Brothers off their first record. It's called Trouble No More. It's a cover of Muddy Waters, and the beginning absolutely shreds.
Oh, right on the guitars. The doors are swinging open. Yeah. Obviously, this bar has saloon-style doors. It's not like a knob that's being turned. It's just like two doors being pushed open. Hopefully,
this bar is open 24 hours a day. They only need saloons.
It's either like the bar from the Blues Brothers where they play and there's the chicken wire up and they get all the beer bottles thrown at them, or it's like the bar from Roadhouse. It's just a bar with nothing but fighting.
Which is
I was
only
thinking
fighting.
Roadhouse.
This bar is only fighting.
I was totally thinking Roadhouse. No, this is good. When you were saying Allman Brothers, I was like, please be Jessica.
We just play Jessica, and we burst please in.
Just throwing fists.
I would be afraid if you guys came in listening to this song. I would be afraid.
Oh, yeah. I just got scared.
There's going to be trouble.
There's an extreme bluesy swagger. I guess, I don't know. I am just picturing that Andrew does one of those moves where he laces his fingers together and holds them real low, and I step on him, and then he hoists me into the air to do a jump kick.
Classic bar fight move. You can tell we've been in a lot
you
of bar
tell.
Fights.
A lot of bar fights. Yeah.
Yeah, that's literally the move from Double Dragon 2. Those are the only fight moves we know are the combo moves from Double Dragon 2.
Yeah.
The 1988 Nintendo game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, this is a good one, guys. I really like this one.
Thank you very much. The track is Trouble.
There's
no
like there's bottles of beer being broken and just like stabbed into other patrons.
You're stepping across peanuts.
Yeah.
Peanut shells.
Oh, peanuts everywhere. Especially, and then you're fighting people with peanut allergies.
You know, when you described like, it's like a Roadhouse style bar, it just conjured an image where now we're just a character in the Roadhouse video game, and this is our theme song, but there's also, like, you know, a really giant dude from the Ukraine, like Zangief or something like that, you know.
This is the Texas Roadhouse.
The Texas Roadhouse, where we battle beneath the 80-ounce steak plaque.
Eat the steak that killed Jason Gore from 105.3 The Bear.
Oh, man.
Speaking of 105.3 The Bear, I want to thank you very graciously for your time and invite all of our listeners to follow all four of us on Twitter. I'm Get Some Evan. Andrew is A. Rose Gregory. Kristen is still Kristen Cheeks, I believe.
Still Kristen
and
Cheeks.
Jason is known as Sonic Dork. But would you do us the kind favor, Jason, of doing something that we have yet had the courage to do, which is to create a station ID for our podcast and just tell people that they have been listening to Punch Up the Jam in your best bear voice?
You've been listening to Punch Up the Jam. It's over. The podcast is finished. Go on to listening to what other podcasts you listen to.
Let's punch it.
This has been Punch Up the Jam.
That was a HeadGum Original.